Welcome to the Clerk Commute Podcast,
where we discuss clerkship content, share up-to-date research, work through interesting cases, and gather position advice for your next rotation.
We would like to thank BMO Academic Consulting for sponsoring this episode. BMO Academic Consulting helps students get accepted to medical school and matched to top residency programs. After helping over 55,000 students and a success rate of 93.5%, BMO is a leader in admissions for healthcare programs.
As part of their sponsorship to our podcast, BMO is offering all listeners one free session with their admissions advisors. This session can be used to help you with your application documents for either medicine or residency, Casper prep, MCAT prep, or interview prep. You can use the code BMO free session to book your free advising session.
Good morning, clerks. Welcome back to another episode of the Clerk Commute Podcast. Today, we will be working through a case to go over premature rupture of membranes and preterm birth in pregnancy. So Meg, you are a CC3 asked to see a 32-year-old G3P0 at 32 weeks gestation who is presenting with a recent history of gush of fluid per vagina. So let's talk about what you are really trying to figure out when someone presents with a gush of fluid.
Thanks, Alex. So with leakage of fluids, we want to know if Miss J has ruptured her membranes, meaning has the sac that is holding the baby filled with amniotic fluid ruptured. This is important to know for three different reasons. One, this can be an indication that labor will start soon. Secondly, once the membranes rupture, there's increased infection risk, and if labor does not start, the obstetrics team must weigh the risk of infection with the risk of inducing labor, even if preterm. And three, if they are GBS positive and their membranes have ruptured, the team has to start antibiotics. As a pregnant person gets close to labor, the latency period, meaning the time of rupture to the natural onset of labor, shortens. At term, meaning greater than 37 weeks, 90% of pregnant patients who rupture their membranes go into labor within 24 hours, whereas preterm, 50% go into labor within 24 hours, but 70 to 80% go into labor within a week. Rupture of membranes is commonly referred to as PROM, which stands for pre-labor rupture of membranes, or if the labor is also preterm, it is referred to as PPROM, which stands for preterm pre-labor rupture of membranes. But I have a question. On TV, when people break their water, it seems like it would be pretty obvious. Why do we need to run all these tests to make sure it's actually amniotic fluid?
That's a very good question. So the fluid that this woman is reporting can be a few things. Firstly, as the pregnancy goes on, the discharge coming from the vagina changes, and sometimes it can leak down the leg, which women think is their water breaking. Also, the uterus and baby grow, and that pushes more and more on the bladder. So the leakage of fluid might actually be urine.
That makes more sense now. Okay, let's get started on history taking. The first thing I would do is get a general history of what happened. I would confirm mom's age, gestation, GTPAL status, and ask her to tell me about the gush of fluid. Specifically, I would want to know when this happened, whether it was a gush or a trickle, and the color and odor of the fluid. These last two questions can give us clues on whether the fluid is urine, vaginal discharge, or a ruptured membrane. Yellow, mal-odored fluid may indicate urine, and a white or clear odorless mucus may be vaginal discharge. In contrast, a rupture of membranes commonly presents as a sudden gush of clear or pale yellow odorless fluid, which soaks through clothes. However, for many women, the rupture of membranes is a continuous or intermittent trickle of fluid, or just a sensation of abnormal wetness of the vagina. However, it's important to note that a sterile speculum exam of the fluid will be more objective. I also want to confirm the gestational age, because as we mentioned, in preterm labor, there's a longer latency period between rupture of membranes and labor, along with an increased risk of infection. So we will want to learn more about gestational age to better weigh the risks of inducing labor and infection. I would ask about whether the dating was from the last menstrual period or whether this was by ultrasound, because it gives us an idea of the accuracy of the gestational age. A patient's cycle can be irregular, so the standard care for dating is first trimester ultrasound.
Perfect. So Mrs. J confirms that she is a 32-year-old, 32-week plus 2 days gestation based on ultrasound. She has been pregnant 3 times, including this one, but unfortunately lost her other 2 pregnancies spontaneously in the second trimester. Because these losses happened later in pregnancy, I asked if a cause was ever identified, such as an infection, cervical insufficiency, thromboembolic disease, or genetic conditions. Mrs. J said a cause was never identified. Also, great job on mentioning the color of fluid, as it is extremely important for indicating risk, for example, whether it's red due to blood or green. When the amniotic fluid is green, it is referred to as meconium and means the fetus has defecated in utero. Although this can happen in normal birth, it increases our suspicion of fetal distress, such as umbilical cord compression or hypoxia. In this situation, we would be actively monitoring the mom and baby, and we would be more likely to induce labor. Passage of meconium in utero can be dangerous because the fetus could then aspirate their stool, leading to something called meconium aspiration syndrome, where the newborn experiences mild to life-threatening respiratory distress. And to answer your question about telling you more about the fluid, earlier today at around 2 p.m., she was standing in her kitchen where there was a large gush of clear fluid, and she came right into triage to check if this was her water breaking. It is now 6 p.m.
All right. Thanks for that information. The gush of clear fluid makes me suspect PPROM at this point, but I'll need to investigate further to be sure. We'll talk more about preterm birth later, but I think it's important to acknowledge that one of the biggest risk factors for preterm birth is a previous preterm birth. Ms. J has not had a previous preterm birth, or PTB, but she has had 2 spontaneous abortions in the second trimester, which increases the risk that she may go into preterm labor. As we do with all patients presenting to triage, I want to get a better idea of Ms. J's general OB-GYN history and more about this current pregnancy. Before diving in, I'm going to ask mom about any illnesses or previous conditions. This is important in this patient, especially because certain conditions and illnesses, and even medications, can precipitate preterm birth. So I'll make sure to ask about medications and allergies as well.
Great thought. Some conditions and drugs that do precipitate preterm labor are cigarettes, smoking, substance use, hypertension, renal insufficiency, and some autoimmune conditions. For our case, Mrs. J does not have any pre-existing conditions. She does not take any medications and she has no allergies.
Okay, great. Now I can start asking about her current pregnancy. I'd want to know whether she has had antenatal care and screening, ultrasounds, and if so, whether there were any abnormalities, including growth restriction or macrosomia, congenital malformations, etc. Whether mom was diagnosed with any conditions during this pregnancy, specifically gestational diabetes, hypertension, intrauterine infection, or bleeding during pregnancy, any cervical or uterine concerns such as fibroids, and if she was greater than 36 weeks, which in this case she is not, but I would also ask about her GBS status.
Great summary of an important obstetrical history for triage. I will let you know about Mrs. J's answers, but I want you to explain why some of these questions are important. From our case, Mrs. J had antenatal care starting at 11 weeks. She has had genetic screening, which showed no increased risk of abnormalities. Her ultrasound at 22 weeks showed a short cervix, and she has been having serial ultrasounds of her cervical length since. Her last ultrasound showed a cervical length of 20 millimeters. She's been managed medically for her short cervix with vaginal progesterone gel. She has not been diagnosed with GDM, hypertension, or any infections during her pregnancy, but she has not had her GBS swab yet. Before we move on, why did you ask these questions and how do they relate to a potential PPROM?
These questions are relevant because they can help me assess what risk factors Ms. J might have for PPROM. Risk factors for PPROM include complicated GDM, preeclampsia, intrauterine infection, bleeding during pregnancy, cervical insufficiency, uterine malformations, and fetal factors or growth restriction. Also, we're assessing for any other factors that could be complicating the pregnancy independent of PPROM. In this case, Ms. J has no risk factors other than the possibility of cervical insufficiency due to the short cervix. Like I mentioned earlier, Previous pre-prom or preterm birth are also risk factors for pre-prom. And then moving on to my four cardinal triage questions. One, if mom is feeling any contractions. Two, if she feels the baby move. Three, whether there has been any blood coming from her vagina. And four, any leakage of fluid, which we already know the answer to is yes.
Awesome job for remembering. Mrs. J is not feeling contractions. She does feel the baby move normally, as in a consistent way to her previous experience with the baby's movements, and there has been no blood. It's important to ask the mom to compare to her baby's normal movements because decreased fetal movements is still significant.
The lack of bleeding could be reassuring. This is because bleeding from placental abruption or placenta previa can trigger preterm labor. If you remember from one of our earlier episodes, both of these conditions can be very serious and can lead to significant bleeding and maternal and fetal instability. The fact that she can feel the baby move is also reassuring, because reduced fetal movements could indicate fetal distress or demise. All right, I'm done with my history. Before I move on to the investigations, I'm going to summarize. Ms. J is a 32-year-old G3P0 who is presenting with gush of fluid per vagina. On history, it is likely that this is PPROM, given the gush of odorless clear fluid and possible cervical insufficiency, which is a risk factor for PPROM. Otherwise, Ms. J has no risk factors for preterm birth or PPROM. Moving on to physical exam, we should always start with vitals. And in this case, we would also include a non-stress test to assess fetal heart rate. With OB patients, we should also do an abdominal exam to check for tenderness, which could be a sign of intrauterine infection or placental abruption. We could do Leopold maneuvers to determine fetal position, and if we are unsure about the position, a bedside ultrasound to confirm cephalic presentation is prudent. For this case, I, as the clerk, would encourage the team to avoid conducting the vaginal exam unless absolutely necessary, because this increases the risk of infection, which can be dangerous for the mother and baby. Instead, I would suggest that the team perform a speculum exam. This exam will allow me to visualize the leakage of fluid and sample the fluid for analysis. Dilation up to 2 to 3 centimeters can also be visualized on speculum. One feature to look for in the speculum is pooling, which is visible fluid sitting under the posterior fornix of the cervix. Pooling is a pertinent positive for this fluid being amniotic fluid. The speculum exam will also allow me to take a sample of the fluid to test the pH and to look for something called ferning. Ferning is what happens when salt in the amniotic fluid crystallizes as the fluid dries on the microscope slide, and under the microscope, it looks like a fern. In addition, we can test the fluid with nitrazine paper, which will turn from yellow to dark blue in the presence of amniotic fluid. However, the nitrazine test is not perfect and changes color in the presence of any basic fluid. Therefore, there are several other fluids which could lead to a positive test, for instance, semen in the vaginal canal. To summarize, we use the features of pooling, ferning, and pH to decide whether this is amniotic fluid. Typically, two of these three findings is enough to identify amniotic fluid, but the presence of ferning alone is also a very strong indicator.
That's fantastic. A speculum exam was performed, which showed pooling of fluid in the vagina and fluid leaking from the cervix. The sample of fluid has been analyzed and is confirmed to be amniotic fluid with both ferning and a positive pH test. Are there other investigations that you would like to order?
Yes. Now that it has been confirmed that Ms. J has had a preterm pre-labor rupture of membranes, we should admit her to hospital to monitor her and the baby closely. If this case we confirmed was PROM rather than PPROM, admission might be dependent on resources available and patient preference. It is only appropriate to wait if the mom is GBS negative and everything else is normal. But typical practice is to offer induction as soon as the unit can accommodate her. And there isn't a standard amount of time that is okay for moms with pre-labor rupture to wait. Considering a prolonged rupture greater than 18 hours is a risk factor for infection. I will also need to gather more information to help us determine how to best manage mom and baby during the time approaching labor and delivery. Maternal and fetal vitals should have already been evaluated as part of the initial triage exam. So at this point, once the patient is admitted, we would get a formal OB ultrasound to evaluate growth, fluid, placental position, and confirm presentation. After 32 weeks, we typically won't measure cervical length, as we know it will be dynamic, and a short cervix after that point is not reliably correlated to preterm labor or poor outcomes. During the speculum exam, we should have also taken the opportunity to do swabs of the cervix for STI testing, including gonorrhea and chlamydia, of the vagina for bacterial vaginosis and yeast and culture insensitivity, and a swab for GBS, since she has not likely had this test before. If she tests positive for GBS, then we will need to start IV antibiotics during labor. I would also do a CBC, blood group and screen, and a urinalysis and urine culture sensitivity, considering that UTI is also a risk factor for PPROM and preterm. I would also do a CBC, blood group and screen, and a urinalysis and urine culture insensitivity, considering that UTI is also a risk factor for PPROM and premature labor. Like I mentioned earlier, infection is a major risk factor for PPROM. Therefore, as we are doing all these other investigations, we should continue to check Ms. J's temperature and monitor for signs of infection.
Perfect. Thank you for ordering those investigations. Mrs. J is GBS negative, negative for STIs, and she has no fever. Mrs. J's and the fetus's vitals are normal. Now what do you do?
Now this is where things get complicated. We have two options at this point. Either we induce labor, or we administer antibiotics to prevent infection and prolong latency between PPROM and delivery. In order to make this decision, we need to weigh the risks and benefits of both. The latter will keep the baby in utero longer, therefore allowing the fetus to further develop and reducing the risk of newborn medical conditions associated with prematurity, such as respiratory distress syndrome, which occurs when the baby's lungs haven't fully developed. On the other hand, a long latency period between rupture of membranes and labor and delivery can lead to increased risk of maternal infection, newborn infection, and NICU admission. Whenever membranes are ruptured, we induce labor using oxytocin. Mrs. J is only 32 weeks pregnant, and therefore would benefit from prolonging the pregnancy and allowing the baby to develop further before delivery, unless there are contraindications which could put her and or the baby at risk, such as an infection. Let's say we decide to manage expectantly.
Quick question, would we call this expectant management?
Good point. Expectant management is waiting for the mother to deliver naturally. However, because we are taking active steps to prolong delivery and doing more than watching and waiting, it's a bit more involved than true expectant management. This is a high-risk pregnancy, and we need to try to protect and help the fetus develop as much as possible before delivery. For any pregnancy that is less than 34 weeks, such as in this case, I would order antibiotics for the mom. PPROM antibiotics have been shown to both decrease the risk of infection and increase latency, independent of infection. Typically, the Mercer protocol is used, which is 48 hours of IV antibiotics, followed by 5 days PO. Tocolytics are also medications that are used to stop contractions and can prolong pregnancy for about 48 hours. However, these are not indicated in patients who have not begun contractions, like Mrs. J. I would also order stat steroids to help increase fetal lung development. Steroids can also reduce the risk of brain bleed, necrotizing enterocolitis, and mortality of the newborn. Depending on the steroid that is used, there needs to be 2 to 4 doses given over a 48-hour period. Mrs. J is not GBS positive, so we don't have to worry about GBS prophylaxis in this case. Magnesium sulfate can also be ordered for neuroprotection of the fetus if it is less than 32 weeks gestation. However, in this case, Mrs. J is not in labor, is being treated with latency antibiotics, and is over 32 weeks gestation, so magnesium sulfate is not indicated. Finally, depending on what hospital we're at, I would consider transporting Mrs. J to a center that is better equipped to manage preterm birth. I would continue to monitor the mom and baby closely for signs of maternal or fetal distress or infection, which could require immediate delivery.
Wow, fantastic. It sounds like Mrs. J is in good hands with you. To end, let us summarize the case with our final management plan. So Mrs. J is a 32-year-old G3P0 at 32 weeks plus 2 days gestation who is presenting with a recent history of gush of fluid per vagina. She has not had contractions or bleeding per vagina and fetal movements felt are normal. Mrs. J is previously healthy with no medical conditions and is not taking any medications or substances such as cigarettes or alcohol. Her pregnancy has been uncomplicated thus far, aside from a shortened cervix, which she has been regularly monitored for. There has been no bleeding during this pregnancy, no intrauterine infection, and no concerns about fetal development. She has had 2 spontaneous second trimester abortions in previous pregnancies. A speculum exam was performed, which showed pooling of fluid in the vagina and fluid leakage from the cervix. The fluid was sampled and confirmed to be amniotic fluid. Mrs. J was also swabbed for GBS and tested negative. Mrs. J's and the fetus's vitals were monitored, and neither were found to be in distress. Mrs. J did not have a temperature, so no infections were suspected. Based on these findings, we diagnosed Mrs. J with PPROM and chose to prolong the pregnancy as much as possible and improve fetal outcomes. We administered steroids and she'll remain an inpatient for IV antibiotics for at least 48 hours, after which an individualized decision will be made regarding discharge. The plan moving forward is to continue to monitor Mrs. J and the fetus closely. We are monitoring for signs that Mrs. J has begun laboring, in which case delivery of the premature baby would be imminent and stat newborn care would need to be arranged, such as admission to the NICU. In addition, we are monitoring for any signs of maternal or fetal distress, such as infection, which is common with a long latency period between rupture of membranes and labor. We would suspect infection if Mrs. J developed a fever, and if her amniotic fluid became purulent or malodorous, or if Mrs. J or the fetus presented with distress. In the case of infections, we may need to deliver more imminently and treat accordingly. Most OBs recommend induction of labor at 34 weeks if labor has not spontaneously occurred at this point. This will be our last episode for the academic year. We will be taking a pause during the summer to plan for some new exciting things in the fall. So we will see you in September for the release of our next set of episodes.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Clerk Commute Podcast.
Catch you on your next commute.